It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
I'm wearing clothes, yeah, it's fine.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Jorge Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here and checking out the series. Please do hit that subscribe button. If you like what you see, what you hear, I'll give you three brand new interviews every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover some new ones at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, at Spotify and Podchaser, NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcasts from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, get to catch up with Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie. They've got a new album, Asphalt Meadows. In fact, it's the 10th album from the band. So we're going to talk about, he's going to tell us about making the record in this really interesting assembly line style, the anxiety attacks that play throughout the lyrics, and taking stock of his past. We also get to hear about channeling Slint on one of the tracks and working with Noah Cyrus recently on her latest album. And it's then that we turn the attention to the upcoming reunion of the Postal Service. If you're listening to this episode, you've probably no doubts heard that later on in 2023, Ben is going to be doing double duty on the stage, celebrating the one album from the Postal Service in full, as well as Death Cab for Cutie's Transatlanticism. On stage, all nights, that's him, both albums back to back. So we're going to hear about that. And hear about the indie rock movement of the early 2000s, how making only one album with Jimmy Tamborello led to the band and really the LP's legacy and mythology, and the way his writing and recording has changed since that era as well. So it's all that and a whole lot of attention on Asphalt Meadows. It's Kyle Meredith with Death Cab for Cutie's Benjamin Gibbard.
Hey, how's it going?
It's great to see you. And let me just say, first off, congratulations on this record. I instantly love it. It's never happened that there's been any album that you put out that I haven't loved. So that's a good run that you're still on.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, it's at 10 records in, there's bound to be some ones that people love slash like slash are indifferent about all the way to hate. So that's a good response. I appreciate that.
Is there a Death Cab album that people hate? Like, you know, ranking, sure, like more than others, but I don't think I've ever heard that one. I was like, oh, I hate that record.
Well, I'll just put it this way. I don't see, thankfully, I tend to not see a lot of our albums in the used bins, which makes me think that either they exist there for a short period of time and then people scoop them up, or there's not a universally agreed upon worst record. You know, I mean, I wouldn't put that to a vote. I'm sure if Reddit, and I'm sure the Death Cab Reddit might have some feelings on that, but there doesn't seem to be one, at least, that, you know, is like everybody's agreed in mass is a piece of crap. So that's, we got that going for us, which is nice.
Although I'll take up for the used bin a little bit as someone who still likes, you know, diving in. I always found that most of it is just the albums that too many people had. You know, you had the album that everybody had. So of course you're going to see that stuff in there, like, you know, for a dollar or whatever, which doesn't make it a bad album. It's just, yeah, I don't know how to get it. Everybody gets sick of it at some point, you know.
I was in a few record stores yesterday and I saw records in the new used arrivals that were far better than anything that we've ever made or I've ever been a part of. You know, when you see like Zeppelin and Beatles and Smith's records and whatever else in there, it's like, you know, it's the used bin is not a it's not an indication of it being bad music. It might just be what you said. Either people have heard it enough or there's a new version of you know, the Led Zeppelin catalog, let's say, is getting reissued again and people want to buy those. I do find it interesting, though, when somebody seems to have broken up with an artist and you see that breakup in the used bin. Like, let's just pick a random band that let's say, like, you go to a record store and you see five Wonder Stuff records like in the used bin. It's like, what happened here? You know, I mean, did I have to look up online and see if, like, did the singer of the Wonder Stuff say some crazy right wing nonsense or whatever? Or did he say some racist stuff or something that I'm not aware of? I was like, no, nope, somebody just decided they were done with the Wonder Stuff for whatever reason. And they didn't need these records anymore. And now they're available for me to purchase.
I've had that same thought, especially when I find like singles, you know, because we used to buy singles, especially, you know, CD singles and everything. When you start seeing those in there in group, I feel the same way. It's like, you were a big enough fan that you bought the singles, you know, you wanted the B-sides.
Yeah. Like, I think that makes a little more sense to me, though, because now that those things are available digitally virtually everywhere, and a CD, for example, a CD single, if we're staying on that topic, seems like a thoroughly unnecessary thing to hold on to. They haven't accrued value over time, at least not to my knowledge. They're not particularly rare or collectible. So that makes a little more sense to me.
My wife would agree with you. Over my shoulder is way too many CDs that she probably would like for me to some of them that's taking up the space. I'll say this, and we'll get into this record too. If I were lucky enough to find Death Cab singles, because not, you know, there's stuff like you put, there was a live EP I remember coming out like 03, 04 that I don't think is being pressed up right. And like, there's a few of those treasures, like, oh, if I could find that again, you know, in the used bin, like, that's jackpot day right there.
I'm not sure. I to continue on the CD thing, I'm really unsure as to how collectible CDs are in general. So even like what might be seen as a rare CD, there are probably at least 10,000 copies of it in the world, you know. But Happy Hunting, I don't know if I even have that one. So
well, let's talk Asphalt Meadows. Again, it's a great album. So you all have told the story a little bit about this. I think you said assembly line sort of way that you put it together, which is really kind of fascinating to me. Like, I've heard of different ways to make an album, and maybe it's just the way you're wording this, but I don't think I've heard it this way too many times. Just to kind of set up this album and how it was put together, could you talk about how you all made it in that fashion?
Yeah. So, you know, roughly half or a little more than half are songs that kind of started from a traditional MO, which is like me in this room working on music and sending demos to the guys. But early in the pandemic, I was starting to hit a little bit of a creative wall. And because we had no reason to not try something new, I suggested to the guys that we do, we attempt this songwriting kind of chain letter of sorts, where, you know, 5 days in a work week, five members of the band, and we would choose a random order of the five of us that wouldn't necessarily start with me as the songwriter, creating a piece of music. So let's say on Monday, Dave writes a thing on guitar and, you know, puts it on a click track or drum machine, or whatever, uploads it to a Dropbox. The next day, Nick would put it down, add bass to it, put it back up. Wednesday, maybe I pull it down, add lyrics, melody, maybe some guitar, so on and so forth, till Friday when everybody had contributed and we had a song. And the rules were that you only had 24 hours to turn around what you were working on. So there was a deadline. And also you had complete editorial control while you had the music. So if you didn't like something the person had done the day before, it's gone. Just get rid of it. So we kind of immediately had success with this MO. And I think one of the reasons that we did was that for me as a songwriter, it took me out of my harmonic and kind of melodic tropes. You know, when I'm sitting with an instrument and I'm playing guitar or something, my hands are going to similar places on the instrument. That's going to probably dictate how I sing and what I sing about. But if Zach sends in a piece on piano that has a key change for the chorus or something like that, that wouldn't necessarily be something that I would do, at least not subconsciously. So it allowed us to kind of just get out of, to be reacting musically rather than trying to assert oneself. And then also, because we were kind of stacking these songs, you know, at least stacking the arrangement and not even in a traditional order, it meant that, you know, if you were on Wednesday and somebody had added keyboards and drums and you were the bass player, okay, well then you're Nick, you have to find how to fit into what already exists. And then on Thursday, if I'm going, let's say, I have to react to what already exists on the track. So it was I felt it worked really well from an arrangement perspective, because whomever's day it was reacting to whatever was building the song at that moment and trying to add to it while not taking up too much space. Because I think sometimes when you're in a room with people and everybody's got their amps up all the way, you're trying to find what you're playing on a song, it can be incredibly wrought and kind of anxiety inducing. And then, or if you're in the studio and the clock is ticking, money is being spent, and you're sitting in a corner trying to figure out what you're going to play on guitar or keyboard or whatever, that's also kind of anxiety inducing. So everybody had a day just to sit with a song and kind of try to find their place in it, which was really helpful.
So at this point, you know, when everybody's getting, do you have like scratch vocals already on it? Because what I'm wondering is how possibly the lyrics start to affect what they're coming up with as well.
It just depended on what day of the week I was going. So sometimes it would be Friday and I'd have like basically the complete song that I was just putting words and melody to. Sometimes it would be on a Tuesday and like Nick had gone before me, so I'm just reacting to like a bass line. So, but the rule was, as I stated, you have to complete something. You have to turn into something that's done. You know, oftentimes there would be some editing after the fact, but the point was to kind of just present a full thought on a deadline rather than, you know, what I normally do is just sit in this room and kind of, oh, if I'm not feeling it, I'll go out, get some lunch. And actually I want to go to a record store. Or I'm going to call this guy, see if he wants to get coffee. It was like, no, Wednesday's my day. I have to spend the day in the studio. I have to produce on that day.
And we'll be right back right after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie. And let me say, you know, when I first get into it, those first two songs, I'm not saying like you're always known for like happy-go-lucky songs, you know, one way or the other, but it doesn't seem like we open in a very happy place with this album. I don't know. Do you hear it like that? And if so, how does that set up? And I guess what we're also talking about is when you sequence the record, you know, does it tell a story in that way for you?
Well, for me, I wanted to start the record with I Don't Know How I Survive. I kind of felt after I wrote that song, and that was a song that was kind of just that wasn't a chain letter song. The first two are not. The first thing I wanted when we talked about the song and also dealing with John is like I wanted that first big wall of guitars to kind of feel like you were being punched in the face. So you were kind of felt as if you were settling into kind of a traditional kind of Death Cab groove of sorts, and then you know something came out of left field. But I felt it kind of sets the record up lyrically well because it's a song about, you know, just, you know, anxiety attacks in the middle of the night during a global pandemic, you know, where it's just this idea of like, what is happening? And, you know, just getting through. Sometimes I think when you're somebody's in crisis, just getting through the night is a huge deal. And I found that in my own life. I'm sure a lot of people listening or watching will probably feel the same way. It's not the days that are difficult for me. It's the night. It's like, it's when the voices in your head start going and you can't quiet them down. Though that's a difficult time for me. And I'm sure a lot of other people as well.
And it does punch you in the face when that comes in. It's one of my favorite moments of the whole record right there. I mean, I love hearing you guys do that kind of sound.
We love it too. And I think after being indoors for the most part for a couple of years, or at least not being able to get in a room and crank up the amps, more so because we live in four different cities and, you know, we were being very careful about maybe at this time, maybe looking back, maybe a little overly cautious, but you know, we were doing the best we could with the information we had, overly cautious about not congregating and working on music. It just was, you know, nobody wanted to hop on a plane. People had kids in school. It was like, everything seemed like a vector at that point, you know? And I think after a couple of years of not being able to get in a room and make loud noises, the last thing I wanted to do was to make a record that was like soft, introspective sounds about isolation. You know, you want to get in a room and crank up the amps and like make it, you know, make some noise.
And maybe it makes sense then, because, you know, once we were all there, once we were all isolated, you couldn't do anything. And if you couldn't do anything, there's nothing much to write about in the present. So I do sense that a lot of artists sort of turned around and looked further back than they might have. And I don't know if that's the way I'm hearing it, but I do hear those moments on this record that I wondered if you found yourself doing that, even in things like Rand McNally. You know, I mean, that's, I don't know if that's an actual specific spot in your life, but that's definitely looking to something further in the past. I mean, is this an album that's sort of escaping the present back to the past?
I think it's, not to kind of have a cop-out answer, but I think it's kind of both. I mean, I think as I'm, you know, I'm 46 years old now, you know, very much in the middle of middle age, you know? And I think that as you crest 40 and kind of enter your 40s, I think a lot of people that I know, at least, and myself included, are both grappling with the choices that we made that got us to where we are in our lives now, and also looking towards the future and kind of wondering what the back nine of our life is going to look like if we're so lucky to have, you know, to be at 40-ish and have lived half your life. You know, I mean, that's still obviously pretty old. So I think that for me, I want to be conscious of not, I don't want an entire record or entire kind of theme of a record to be looking backwards, but I do think it's important to do so in order to kind of give oneself perspective on where they are now. And in that particular song, that I've kind of described that song as kind of like, that's like a torch song for everybody who used to be in this band, who toured with this band, who was around in, you know, the early days of this band. And for me, the core message of the song is that, like, you know, I'm not going to let the light fade. I'm not going to let all the work that we did be for naught. You know, I mean, this is, you know, while people have left this band over the years for a number of reasons or been kicked out, it wasn't for lack of contributing and for lack of being an important force in my life, you know? So to me, that's a song that is kind of wants to address just kind of the silliness but also the romance of living in those lean years of a band when you're crashing on people's floors and you're making meals out of like whatever's left, you know, on the rider backstage, which tends to be just some liquor, candy, and maybe a bag of chips and salsa. You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm sure anybody who's ever been in a band and been on tour who's listening to this has gone backstage and found like a case of beer and a bag of chips and salsa, you know, and that being the extent of the food, you know. So, but those are important, you know, those are important kind of eras to move through in one's life. And also just they're important eras to me as they relate to the band.
Well, whether you intend to or not, a song like that, like, you now have enough music, enough albums. I mean, we're talking about 10 albums here, which should be its own congratulations, by the way. Like, you've hit 10 albums. But when you have this much music for fans, again, and I'm saying whether you intend to or not, we have these little moments where it does seem like Easter eggs, you know. I'm going to stretch on one of them. But we talk about Rand McNally, and I start thinking about your line about getting to travel just by folding a map, you know. And then, I mean, the word asphalt is in the district sleep, you know, that's in the first song of Give Up. Like those little, do you catch those when they happen?
Yeah, I do. And I you know, I'm not unaware of, you know, how, which words kind of weave through the catalog and which, and, you know, I'm very aware of that. But I also think that songwriting is a vocabulary, and there are descriptive words and, you know, physical entities that are important to telling a story. And sometimes they're important to telling more than one story. And I think because of, in songwriting, there's an economy of language that doesn't exist in, you know, writing novels or screenplays, or maybe sometimes even poetry. I mean, there's, you know, at least the way I write songs, there's a certain amount of space that I'm putting words into. So oftentimes there is a descriptor or a word that is required that I might have used before. And it's not for a lack of imagination, I'd like to hope. And maybe maybe I can say slightly defensively, it's more so that, yeah, that those asphalt meadows, those words sound so nice to me. You know, they're not the same as, you know, cellar door, you know, which was once described as the most beautiful pairing of words in the English language. But asphalt meadows, they're both two syllable words. They have nice vowel sounds to them. And the song wouldn't be the same if it was concrete meadows. You know, it wouldn't feel the same. It wouldn't sound the same. It wouldn't sing the same. So oftentimes, you know, as a songwriter, you're also kind of leaning into what words sing well. And that's, you know, as I've worked, you know, I've been working a little bit here and there with younger artists, kind of writing songs from time to time. And you know, that term comes up often with young songwriters, like, how does it sing? And it's something I've never considered, but it is a very interesting way to think about why we choose the words we choose. Some words just sound better coming out of a voice that's singing versus a voice that's speaking.
Just recently, by the way, was talking to one of those songwriters, Noah Cyrus, had her on here. And man, when you get me and her together, I mean, we're two big Death Cab geeks. So that was a fun conversation.
She's wonderful. And she made a really fantastic record, and I'm really proud to have been a small part of it. I'm, you know, there's these moments where I get to spend with some younger artists such as Noah, and I realize, you know, the kids are all right. They've got it. When we shuffle off, you know, they're more than able to kind of pick up the mantle.
Well, it also, like, I love the dynamics of what you can pull off, like an album that you've done with Noah, and then you get something like Foxglove on here that reminds me of Slint, you know, on this new record. Like, that's that's a good balance of songwriting.
Yeah, I think when I was working on, Foxglove, I was up in my studio where I am now, and my wife's studio is below me, and, you know, she hears the music come out of the speakers and hears me, you know, the kind of muted tone of me singing or speaking or whatever. And I came downstairs and she's like, what, are you working on a Slint song up there? And I'm like, kind of.
You're going to be in Louisville here in a few weeks. And I do hope you play that one because, yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. We How could we not? How could we not play it in Louisville?
Do a send up. And then if you could just scream, you know, out Captain right at the end, that would be.
Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting. I mean, that record is, I mean, Spiderland specifically is like a really formative record for me and a lot of people of my generation. And yeah, so naturally there would be, at some point, its influence would kind of cut through.
And we'll be right back, right after this.
Hey, ARMY and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Bosstones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie. With everything that's going on, of course, now we've got more news out of your camp that later on next year, you're going to be spinning it a little bit in the past, as you've, you know, headlined now that you're going to be performing the Postal Service and Death Cab's Transatlanticism, which top three favorite album of all time for me, at the same time. Is this something you're already looking ahead? Because, you know, we're all like, dude, you're going to be like, sure, Springsteen's up there for 3 hours, but is you're going to be up there for a while, right?
Well, I'll say two things on it and why people should not be concerned for me. Number one, the total runtime of this show will be comparable, if not less, than how long Death Cab is currently playing. So, you know, Death Cab tends to play between 22 and 25 songs a night. You know, Give Up is 10 songs, Transatlanticism is 11. You know, it's not as if I'm doing more work, so to speak. And, you know, the plan is to play the records in order in their entirety, just for clarity. Because I feel the celebrating the anniversary of record tour has been everything from we play the record in its order to, oh, it's just a tour where you're playing four or five songs from the record amongst other songs. So that point needs to be made very clear. Secondly, I'm an ultra runner, man. Like, I mean, endurance is not a problem for me. So, you know, I'm not super concerned about, I've had some friends be like, you're going to be exhausted. I'm like, you don't have any idea. It's going to take a lot more than this to make me tired.
So which band takes top billing in this scenario? Like, do you get to choose that?
Well, it made sense for Postal Service to play last as much because it's been 10 years since Postal Service did any shows. And secondly, you know, it's like a dance record, or at least a lot of it is, right? So it would seem a little anticlimactic to go from playing Give Up and then going into, you know, Transatlanticism, which is obviously a record that we love and that people seem to really love too, but you know, it has a lot of down moments in it. So it just made sense that this would be the order that things would go.
I'm gonna take the moment here to stay in that area for a second. Does anything jump out at you when you consider 2003 and what was going on and where you were in your life with these two albums, like artistically speaking?
Yeah, I mean, the, you know, 2001 into 2002, culminating in 2003 with the release of these records, is without a doubt the most creatively prolific period of my career. And, you know, since then I've gone on to write a lot of songs for a particular record. I mean, there were 90 songs that got written for Asphalt Meadows, and I worked with other people and did some guest spots and co-wrote and these kind of things. But from a purely output versus impact perspective, I mean, 2003 was an unbelievably prolific year for me in releasing both these records, also a solo EP with my friend Andrew Kenny, a split EP, but also just that the response of these records when they came out, these records, and I hope my speaking about it in this way does not come off as self-aggrandizing. I think the 20 years since then, you know, I think will kind of mute anybody hopefully feeling that I'm speaking in that manner. But these records that were just released because it was time for Death Cab to make another record, and I had met Jimmy Tamborello and we had worked on a song together that we enjoyed and wanted to make more of it. You know, at the time these records were just going to be like, okay, next Death Cab record, cool, it'll probably sell around 50 or 60,000 copies. That's what the last one did. I think the Postal Service record, the sales kind of expectations for Give Up based on Jimmy and I's other output was like, yeah, we'll be prepared to sell about 15 or 20,000 copies of this record. And the Postal Service record just took on a complete life of its own because we weren't really promoting it or touring or anything. And of course, Sub Pop was working the record. I want to be very clear about that. And, you know, Death Cab got swept up in this larger kind of cultural phenomenon around what indie rock was becoming in the mainstream. So it just was this like weird snowflake of a moment in not only my life, but in just indie rock culture in general, where this music that had been, for all intents and purposes, underground music became, if not mainstream, certainly larger than it had ever been in kind of the cultural context of what, you know, what it, this music, we ever thought this music could accomplish in popular culture. I mean, you know, the biggest venue that I would go to see an independent band in 1999 was like the Showbox. And that's like 1,200 people and be like, wow, Yola Tango is huge. They're playing the Showbox. They're the biggest band in the world. Right. So I speak, you know, there's a quote by William Gibson that I'm going to kind of botch here, but it basically says something along the lines of, I think about my books as my children who left home and got into interesting adventures. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I feel about these records. Like, yes, I had a large part in making them. I am the voice on both of them. But these records left the womb, so to speak, and they became these not only cultural signifiers, but also they became part of the mosaic of people's lives in a way that my favorite records did and continue to do for me. So to speak about these records as if, and what they've meant to people, is not to pat myself on the back. It's more just to kind of stand back in awe of what music can mean in people's lives. And to take it a step further, that I was in some part the author of those moments in some people's lives is an incredibly humbling thing. And I wanted to do this tour, not so much to like stand on stage and like, you know, congratulate myself, but more so to give people what will assuredly be the last time and one last opportunity to see the Postal Service if they hadn't seen it. And to also honor what these records have meant in the lives of the people who have been, I wouldn't say changed, but certainly been affected by them. You know, is it nice? Does it feel good to see that the tickets are flying off the, you know, virtual shelves? Yeah, totally. That's awesome. But, you know, this isn't something that was, you know, this wasn't something that was, you know, kind of concocted out of a desire for financial gain. It was, you know, that will surely be part of it. But, you know, the work, the reason we're doing this work and we were doing these shows is because we want to honor the connection that people have to these records that have meant so much to us in our career and our own lives.
Yeah. And both of them are absolute classics, both those records. Although, you know, the difference is that, of course, Transatlanticism is now part of a catalog and Give Up has always stood on its own. And now those questions have been there throughout the years. You know, would there ever have been one? And there wasn't. Do you think that because there wasn't any more Postal Service has led to the legacy, you know, in that sort of way? Like, you can't get any more. This is what you get.
Oh, assuredly. And I can kind of speak about it away from my own work. I mean, think about Aeroplane Over the Sea by Deirdre Milk Hotel. I mean, this record comes out in 1998. You know, it makes waves amongst a, you know, relatively small community of indie rock connoisseurs. And then over the next 25 years or so, you hear people who you never would think would know anything about the King of Carrot Flowers talking about that song or O Comely, or it was one of those records that, and I'm, you know, I'm not trying to make a direct parallel with Give Up, of course, but it was one of those records that was so good and it was such a transcendent creative expression that it just kind of took on a life of its own and found people who necessarily wouldn't even know about Elephant Six, right? And I think that because, like Give Up, there hasn't been a follow-up, it's allowed Jeff Mangum and Neutral Milk Hotel as an entity to remain this kind of like mythic. It's given it a mythic quality, and it's shrouded in mystery. You know, why hasn't there been another record? What's he doing right now? I heard from a friend who knows somebody who knows him. He was working on something. He was at a studio. It takes on this like this air of mystery and romance, you know. And there's certainly just less of that with the Postal Service. But I'm sure there are people out there who are like, they get a little whisper of something and they go like, oh, you know, somebody texted somebody who said that Jimmy and Ben were having coffee. That must mean, you know, whatever it might be. So it's kind of fun to be a part of that in my own life, because you realize that so much of the mystery that surrounds, I know Neutral Milk Hotel is not a one and done, but for all intents and purposes, let's just kind of call it a one and done, you know, or The Laws or whatever kind of group that had one record and just disappeared. It's really interesting, at least in our case, to be a part of the other side of that and realize like, yeah, no, we just didn't want to do it again. You know, or yeah, we tried and it just wasn't that much fun. So we decided, yeah, why do another one?
Right. Because that's gotta be a part of it. Like if we don't do it, it can live bigger. Like, to keep that in your head. Like, I love that. I do. I love that that's part of it, at least a little bit.
I mean, anybody who's been wanting a second Postal Service record, like, really ask yourself, after 20 years, do you really think that there's going to be something that we could make that could even, you know, satisfy half of the desire you have in your mind as to what this record would be like? A lot of 20 years, a lot of technology has changed, you know, a lot of how we make music has changed dramatically since then. It wouldn't be the same. And I think often when we think about the music that we love the most and the eras of a certain artist or a band that we love the most, we're as much kind of thinking about the sound of the, it's not just the songs. It's just not how you remember, how you were driving around in high school, listening to it, wishing you could be anywhere else than the town you're living in. It's the sound of it. And whatever we would make now would sound dramatically different than what we made 20 years ago. And I think that would be a disappointment, even if we tried.
I was, you know, for the longest time, because you also, a year later, right around that time or whatever, did the song with Styrofoam, the Couches and Alleys. It's like, I was thought, like, well, there's a little bit something there. Like, there were little breadcrumbs afterwards. Anything.
A little things here and there. I did a song with Chong the Nomad. I did a song with, you know, I've done some strong songs with other electronic, you know, artists. So it's kind of like, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm always dipping my toe in that water a bit. But I think at this point, you know, 46 years old, I think it was pretty wild kind of exercise in hubris at 25 or whatever I was, 24, 25, 26, to be like, yeah, I can make two records at the same time. Why not? I mean, that's just like the arrogance of youth, thinking like, yeah, why not? I can totally do this, and they'll both be great. So who gives a shit? You know, sorry, I'm not supposed to swear, but you can
swear all you want.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I will say though that now that we have 20 years to look at that and to hear certain things, like, now we can swim any day in November. Like, I kind of remember the year when that became true more so than it was. Yeah. It felt that, you know, and those little moments, like, I can't wait to go gray. You know, it's like, oh man, what does that sound like now that you're seeing?
Yeah. You know? Well, it's like, I mean, ask Pete Townsend what it's like to be, or Roger Daltrey, sure, what it's like to be saying, hope I die before I get old, right? I mean, there's, and you know, I mean, as far as swimming in November, that would be great, but the West is on fire until December every year now. So it's, you know, it's not so you can't swim outside, it's you really just can't even be outside. But I think that's also kind of one of the beauties about aging with the music that you love and that we make, is that there was a time when rock and roll was thought to be a young person's game, and that, you know, I mean, I'm speaking about in the 60s, the 50s, you know, I mean, this was like, there was no thought that you could play for all intents and purposes, rock and roll past 25, past 25, it would be silly to be strapping on the guitar and windmilling around. Right. But as the art form has aged and become refined in some ways, and then become unrefined and been stripped back down to its essentials and then built back up again, there's always this kind of, you know, this things get more complicated and more like, and more orchestrated, and then they get stripped down to just like guitar and vote, you know, it gets punk. Like, there's these punk motions, movements that happen every 10 or 15 years. You know, I think that it's, you know, rock and roll has just become a part of the cultural fabric of living in the world, and certainly living in the Western world. And the idea that you wrote something at 25 that you don't believe at 46, or that might represent you in a way that you couldn't have seen coming, is just, I think that as someone who's singing songs that I wrote when I was 20, about subjects and people that I know I don't even remotely feel the same way about anymore is kind of like opening up your diary or your high school photos to people in front of a crowd. You know, you're reading a diary from a less emotionally kind of mature part of yourself, and I think that the audiences appreciate that. They appreciate that when an artist doesn't try to kind of gloss over the person they used to be.
I mean, it's really one of the only art forms that you're kind of held to that, right? Like, not held to it in the, I don't mean it like forced to it, but, or handcuffed, but you know, you're always there, you know, those moments that you did sing about, you're still like, that doesn't happen in the other ones to kind of have to.
Yeah. I mean, no one's holding Paul Auster to like, you know, something he wrote in a novel in like 1978 or whatever. You know, it's like, it's not how it works. But that's also kind of the beauty of the connection that we have as songwriters with our audiences. It's that, you know, you're the best compliment I can get. And thankfully I received it from somebody recently I was talking to, was like, yeah, I feel like I've been able to grow older with your records. I've been listening to your records for X amount of years. And I feel like, you know, that the way that I've been writing about my life and the things that I've chosen to write about are that at least some of them are relatable to people who are my age and have been listening to the music all these years, which that's the goal. You know, the goal, you know, it would be pretty pathetic if I was here at 46, like, you know, writing a song about the cops stealing my skateboard. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, or it's like, so, you know, it's like, and that was the height of emotional kind of growth that I had kind of experienced the last 20 years. So that means a lot to me. And that's the goal. Is like, I remember at some point we were listening to playback in the studio, and I said something like, yeah, boy, people are going to love this song about a middle-aged white man and his anxiety. This is going to be a big hit, you know?
Well, I guess I appreciate in the same way that even a record like Give Up, which I see as a very lonely album, even in its peppiness, you know, that version of loneliness has at certain times been as much comfort as anything else. In those moments in Asphalt Meadows, I get the same way. You know, it is a more matured loneliness sometimes, or whatever, you know, the emotion is. But I can honestly say that that you have been great about that in your songwriting.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I feel like I led you to that compliment, but I do feel like, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's like I would hope that if somebody loved Transatlanticism when they were a teenager because it spoke to what they were going through then, that now 20 years later, that something that I would write, not necessarily even for Death Cab, but just in general, would find a place in their life and their existence that they could relate to it. So that's the goal. The goal is to be as honest as possible. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that people have, you know, followed this band as long as they have. I've said often it's easy to be detached and ironic. It's far more difficult, far more dangerous to be earnest. And you open yourself to a lot more mockery for being earnest than you do for being ironically detached.
Yeah. Well, I can say too that when I make a joke about this is the sound of settling after getting home at 10 o'clock, it's no longer a resignation, it's a celebration. So that's,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Like the idea of like going to a show and be like, oh, thank Christ, it's like the show starts at 8, you know. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who writes for a local weekly about the state of Seattle music, and you know, it's everybody's on tour, clubs are, you know, booked all these nights a week, blah blah blah, and I was like, I just don't know why shows can't start at 8 and be over by 10 on a weekday. What is this myth that people need to be out later to drink more? Like, if you can afford to go to a show in Seattle in 2022, you probably have a job that you have to go to in the morning, right? But, you know, and I stand by that statement, but it is the oldest thing I've said in quite a while. And also, the only way I can make it sound older is if I demanded there also be a seat. Like, I must have a seat. I've been standing for 3 hours.
And here you're going to go on tour, and what time will Death Cab go on? 9:15?
We're gonna punish people. We're gonna go on at 11. Shows over at 1:30 in the morning. No, I think we'll get you out of there before. We'll get you out of there. You won't be getting out too late.
I just want to be lost in the music, man. Let's throw a peace sign up when I do that. Yeah, exactly. Asphalt Meadows is so good. Ben, it is always so exciting when you release new music. So thanks for continuing to do it. Man, thanks for taking the time to talk about it today.
Of course. Yeah, it was my pleasure.
My thanks to Ben Gibber, Death Cab for Cutie. The new album is called Asphalt Meadows. And of course, the reunion shows with the Postal Service and celebration of Death Cab's transatlanticism happening later on in 2023. You can also head further into this Kyle Meredith with podcast to hear my 2018 interview with Ben. That's when we were talking about their record, Thank You for Today, and his friendship with Frightened Rabbit's Scott Hutchinson. So that's if you want to find that one, just search in the Kyle Meredith with podcast, Kyle Meredith with Death Cab for Cutie. Thanks to you for checking out this episode. Before you get out, please do hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week, new and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, at Spotify and Podchaser, NPR, WFPK.org, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcasts from, subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Then after that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show. Monday through Friday starts at 6 p.m. Eastern. Song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all three of them. The address is at Kyle Meredith. So I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
That was fun. I guess I'll see you in about a month or something like that, right? Have a great weekend. I'll talk to you soon.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.